Yes, sir.
Mr. Yudishin.
Welcome.
Good Thank morning. You. Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Robert Yudishin, and I represent Michael Adams. Mr. Adams was indicted in Collin County, Texas, for the offense of capital murder. The indictment alleged that Mr. Adams intentionally caused the death of Nicole Ledger by shooting her with a firearm while in the course of committing the offense of retaliation. Mr. Adams entered a plea of not guilty to that indictment and proceeded to a jury trial. At the conclusion of the trial court instructed the jury on the law. There was no instruction on the law parties. None was asked for by the state, and the trial court did not give an instruction on the law parties. So the jury was told that in order to find Mr. Adams guilty of capital murder, they had to find that he personally, beyond a reasonable doubt, committed each and every element of the offense of capital murder. At the conclusion of the trial, the jury returned a verdict of guilty, even though no rational jury could have found that Mr. Adams was present at the scene of the offense or that he is the person who shot and killed Nicole Ledger. There was no eyewitness testimony. No eyewitness said he or she saw Mr. Adams commit this offense. No eyewitness placed him at the scene. No one placed him in the neighborhood. There was no video of Mr. Adams being at the scene. There was no murder weapon that was found and connected to Mr. Adams that was used in this offense. There's no cell phone records placing him anywhere near Miss Adams' home. There's no hairs from Mr. Adams' body or fibers from his clothes or shoe prints. No gunpowder residue was found on Mr. Adams. The only thing that the state relies on, and if you look at the opinions of the state court of appeals and the magistrate judge and the district judge below, is one instance of touch DNA that was found on another man's used condom inside Miss Ledger's home. Judge Jordan below said that that DNA does not definitively place Mr. Adams in the home, and I would completely agree with that. Now, Judge Jordan did not explain, though, how he came to the conclusion that this jury verdict was rational based on that.
Counsel, I'll be honest with you. I do see the force in your argument from the evidence. But how is the argument that you're making now to this court on federal habeas any different from that argument that would have been made to the jury? I assume that those powerful arguments were made to the jury as a reason to acquit or not find not guilty. So how is it different? I mean, we're in a different forum here.
Yeah, we are in a different forum, but the reason, like Jackson versus Virginia made it clear that under due process, it is the responsibility of an appellate court, whether in starting initially with the state appellate court, to decide whether the jury's verdict was rational and complied with the due process requirement that each and every element must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, was Jackson a habeas case?
Jackson was a habeas case.
It was.
But
I'm sorry, did you say it was or was not?
Was, I think.
No, sir. It was a direct appeal. So help me understand your answer to Judge Duncan, because I'm hung up on the same thing. What would be the best case that you have for how we are to apply Jackson versus Virginia under AEDPA? You agree that we have to apply AEDPA. So we're not asking whether a rational juror could have found each element of the crime. We're asking whether a rational jurist in the Texas state system could have found that a rational juror would have found each element of the crime. And I've read your brief several times, and I haven't seen a case that you've identified for us doing that latter inquiry, right? Rational jurist finding a rational jury. It's double rational. Can you give me a case?
Well, let me start with a couple of things, Judge, and I'll respectfully disagree. First, Jackson versus Virginia was a habeas case.
What do you mean when you say that?
Well, it was a case that arose out of Virginia where they were talking about a state conviction and whether there was, in that case, whether there was evidence of premeditation to commit a murder. And... But, so, let me, let me move on and try to address your question more directly.
Well, I just want to make sure you and I are on the same page, because
okay.
I want to make sure that we're not talking past each other. And I'm sure the presiding judge will make sure that you have ample time to get to your argument. This is really important, and I want to make sure we're on the same page. If you're convicted in a state system and you petition to the Supreme Court of the United States on direct appeal of your state conviction, that is not habeas. That is a direct appeal of a federal question to, in that case, the Supreme Court of Virginia, which you could have done. I don't remember if you did or did not in this case. You could have gone from the denial of petitionary of discretionary review in the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and you could have done that to the Supreme Court of the United States, and that would be a direct appeal. It's not where we are. We're on collateral review. Are we on the same page now?
Sure.
Okay.
Let me address that issue. So,
sure.
So I would think the analysis that this court should engage in first is whether the Jackson standard is met, whether a rational jury could have found Mr. Adams guilty. The idea of double deference, at least in my opinion, is difficult to apply in a situation where you're talking about sufficiency of the evidence. Because if a jury's verdict was not rational, to say that a state appellate court that affirmed an irrational verdict was reasonable, in all honesty, makes no sense.
Well, then AEDPA would not add anything to the analysis.
Well, AEDPA says that, and there's a lot of cases that talk about double deference. But I think
to be fair to you, those when we talk about double deference, what I think of is the ineffective assistance of counsel, which has a double deference aspect to it. But you know, here, I mean, I guess AEDPA has to mean something because circuit courts have been rebuked by the Supreme Court repeatedly for sort of pretending that or not recognizing that AEDPA adds something to habeas corpus analysis.
Well, and on the flip side of that, just recently the Supreme Court, I guess in Pitchford versus Kane, made it
yes,
clear.
Yes, I'm familiar with that case.
Yes, said that AEDPA and this double deference idea doesn't mean this court abdicates its duty to review what happened in Mr. Adams' case. And it doesn't mean you can't grant relief. I mean, there has to be...
Those things are certainly true. I do agree with those parts of the Supreme Court's opinion.
Well, and I thought you might disagree with their conclusion.
Well, regardless, I'm stuck with it, so...
No, I understand. But so I would come back, and AEDPA is... When I taught law school at SMU, this is the kind of question on the double deference idea that I could torture law students with it. If a jury verdict is irrational... But on appeal, in this arena, you can't overturn it because some state court already reviewed it and said.
But how do we show deference to the state court then?
Well, I think I'll come back to Pitchford. I mean, sometimes state courts, just like juries, get it wrong. And, obviously.
But we have to determine, do we not, that every reasonable jurist in the state court's position would have gone the other way.
No, I don't think you have to determine that because you can look at it's not just counting votes. Like in the state appellate court, it was a 2-1 decision. The Court of Criminal Appeals refused discretionary review. The magistrate judge obviously recommended that this writ be denied. The district judge, agreed with that. But your role is not to just add up the votes. Say, well, all these judges said... this verdict was reasonable.
But how do we then assess what they did?
Well,
the state court.
So let's take the state court of appeals opinion. The court of appeals outlines a lot of evidence that they say supports the verdict. And if you look at all that as a whole and give all the reasonable inferences to the state like you should, none of that evidence establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that Mike Adams was at the scene of the offense. And the state court, the district court below, no one ever really explains how it does add up to that. And so really your job, if you can look at the reasoning and the conclusions that they drew, but I think in the first instance you have to say, was this jury verdict rational? How could
so we're doing a de novo review for sufficiency.
Well, you're doing... it is a de novo review in the sense that it's a legal analysis.
Well, sure, but I mean, in other words, it sounds like we're just doing a sufficiency analysis with the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict.
Well, but that's what Jackson versus Virginia asked you to do, that you put it in the light most favorable.
I know exactly what you're saying, but if we were on direct appeal, if we were the fifth, what is it, the fifth court of appeals in Texas? If we were that court, then yes, we are doing the standard Jackson versus Virginia analysis. But we're not that court. We're a different court. And so we have to, don't we have to say, we're looking at the Fifth Court of Appeals, was their application of Jackson versus Virginia was so off the rails that like nobody, you know, I mean, I can come up with hypotheticals for how one could do that.
Yeah. I think you do have to say that in a sense, because you have to look at what they looked at, which is the jury verdict. Yeah. Because I'll come back to what
so
I said.
I guess my only point, and I wouldn't think that it would be controversial, but my only point is we're asking a different question than the Fifth Court of Appeals with respect to Jackson versus Virginia.
Well, you are. It's a different question. Again, you're right. You have to ask whether the Fifth Court of Appeals in Texas made a reasonable decision. But what I'm hard-pressed.
Not a correct decision, but a reasonable
decision. A reasonable decision. And I'm hard-pressed to find some scenario in which you could say that a decision affirming an irrational verdict was reasonable. And I think that's what you have to look at. You have to look at what was this verdict by the jury rational. And if it was rational, then I think really that's, in my opinion, that's the end of the analysis. If it was irrational, I don't know how you can come to the conclusion, well, yes, it was irrational. The jury could not have determined that Mike Adams was at the scene.
So are we back to the idea that there's really no distinction between our job, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and the Fifth Court of Appeals for Texas? Because if there's no distinction, then I'm curious what the case prop citation for that would be.
Well, there's not a case citation I give you. That's where the cases do talk about this idea under EPA of double deference, and it works really well in an ineffective assistance of counsel case. It does not work well, in my opinion, in a sufficiency of the evidence case, because I don't know how you can look at the Court of Appeals opinion from the state court and say, well, they cited Jackson versus Virginia, and they went through this analysis and talked about a lot of evidence, and so that must be reasonable. They applied the right standard. But if you look at the evidence that they talk about that supports the verdict, none of it gets you to Mike Adams was at the scene.
So either AEDPA doesn't add anything here and we just do a sufficiency analysis as though it was a direct appeal, or AEDPA adds something and the double deference means claims like yours just fail.
Yeah, and which is where I think I come back to Pitchford, and you can't say that double deference means that we lose because whatever the state court did was okay.
And I should say claims like yours fail. Maybe it's not that categorical, but here you have a court of appeals in Texas that grappled with the evidence, articulated evidence. It wasn't a slipshod analysis or two summary or just a one-sentence order or anything like that. They actually grappled with the record and explained why they saw the evidence as sufficient, correct?
Well, correct, but if you read it, and I would ask you to go back and read it, how do you get from the evidence that they cite to Mike Adams being at the scene?
Well, he did Google searches about where she lived. He was doing coordinates. The tarp and the handcuffs showed up at her porch, a week or two before she was murdered. That's exactly what he did with her at their prior residence. His phone goes dark for 2 days, including the time where they thought the murder happened. Then the phone went live that afternoon. He was very articulate and detailed about his alibis that afternoon, but nothing that morning. I was trimming my bushes. And so there's nothing really to put him not at the site either, but there is something in the record to suggest that he was planning to go there and be there. So, yeah, it cuts both ways, but you can't say there's no evidence.
Yeah, so the evidence, this is like what we said in the brief. There's evidence of motive, perhaps an opportunity.
He said he was going to kill her.
She said he
was going to kill her.
But that doesn't mean he did kill her. That's motive. Sure. And that doesn't mean that he was at the scene and actually is the one that pulled the trigger on that gun and killed her. I mean, that's the problem with it. You have evidence of motive. You have evidence kind of opportunity, but this idea, if you really read the trial record, that he wasn't articulate about where he was in the morning. I mean, you're talking about a window between 8 o'clock in the morning when Nicole Ledger son left for school in 10:45 or so, where maybe he had an opportunity to kill her. When he told the police, and he did this voluntarily, told them he was at home, he didn't use his phone, but he told them where he was that morning. And looking at the evidence, there's every reason to believe that between 8 and whenever she was killed, probably multiple men were in and out of that house having sex with her. There's an unknown DNA from a number of men. This idea that his phone went dark is not entirely accurate if you read the record. I mean, there's testimony in the record from a cell phone expert that analyzed the cell phone for months prior to this. His usual pattern was not making phone calls before 11 o'clock in the morning. That wasn't some just something that happened a couple of days.
In your view, the touch DNA on the condom, is that no evidence whatsoever of presence, or is it simply evidence from which an inference could be drawn of presence or not?
It's evidence that the DNA was present, but because Nicole Ledger and Mike Adams lived together, they were engaged, even before they started living together, there's evidence in the record that they, when they were dating back in 2012, they were staying in each other's homes. And every expert, state's expert, defense expert at trial testified that all that touch DNA shows you is that the DNA was there. It doesn't tell you when it got there, how it got there. It could last for years. It could be transferred. The thing, I don't think you can draw an inference that from that DNA being there that that means he was there.
Okay, so you're, I see.
You have
some time for rebuttal as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's see, Ms. Reeves.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. This case is about the targeted planning and violent escalation of a man so obsessive that at the conclusion of his relationship with his ex-fiancée, Mr. Adams brutally raped and kidnapped the victim in March of 2013. He then stalked and harassed her from April through August of 2013, taunting her and threatening to kill her. And ultimately, in September of 2013, Mr. Adams entered the victim's home, and at close range, he shot her to death.
Well, I mean, the evidence is what the evidence is, but help us with what our task is here.
Your Honor,
you heard us discussing with counsel opposite. What does AEDPA mean here, and what does Jackson mean, and how do we put those two together?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Jackson, this court cannot defer to opposing counsel's inferences in contradiction with the verdict. Deference must be given to the jury's determinations at trial, and all inferences are made in favor of the verdict.
But that's the Jackson standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, go ahead.
And also, under the deferential standard of AEDPA, federal courts may not overturn a state court conviction unless the decision resulted in an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law or was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts.
So, yes, but that's right. That's what AEDPA says. It refers us to a state court decision. Which state court are we deferring to or are we looking to?
Your Honor, we're looking to the decision of the trial court.
Are we? Or are we looking at the Fifth Court, who affirmed, isn't that the last court with a reasoned decision affirming the conviction under Jackson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so I thought, and I could be wrong about this, I actually haven't had an AEDPA case involving Jackson versus mm-hmm. Virginia. Lots involving ineffective assistance of counsel. Mm-hmm. So I understand how deference works there. But here we have the Fifth Court of Appeals, I'm told, by opposing counsel. He's saying, you need to read that decision. Okay? They are applying Jackson. And they are saying, they're looking at the evidence, they're doing a deep dive into the evidence, and saying whether it was a rational jury, rational for the jury to find guilt. So I would think I'm looking at that court and saying, did that court apply Jackson in such a way that's not just wrong, but that is, I don't know, it's just really, really wrong.
Yes,
well, every reasonable jurist would go the other way.
Yes. Well, what Judge Wilson said, Judge Wilson just said the legal standard. I mean, that's what we say. But it's really super wrong. Now, let's put Pitchford to one side. Because I've heard enough about Pitchford. But that's what I thought AEDPA was supposed to be doing. But what do you think?
Yes, Your Honor, excuse me, you would be given deference to the lower court decision, which the most recent court was the Texas Fifth Court of Appeals.
Because the TCCA just, they denied.
Yes.
Whatever they do.
Yes, Your Honor. And this court's precedent has directed reviewing courts not to reevaluate the weight of the evidence or the credibility of witnesses. So therefore, it's not this court's role to ask whether it believes that the evidence...
That's certainly true. That's Judge Oldham's point. That's true if we were the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas.
Yeah. Right?
Now, what Mr. Udishin is saying, probably mispronounced his name again, is... Okay, the Fifth Court of Appeals is looking at the evidence and overlooks the fact that nothing places him there at the scene. Nothing.
Your Honor,
what's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. There was, Mr. Adams had motive, means, opportunity.
No, that motive, means, and opportunity isn't evidence that places him at the scene of the crime, is it?
Your Honor.
Motive, is it?
There is also direct evidence placing him at the scene. And under Jackson... The entirety of the record must be reviewed.
What is the direct evidence placing him at the scene?
The DNA that was found on the surface of a green condom in the victim's master bedroom. Your Honor, there was an active protective order which prevented Mr. Adams from even knowing where the victim stayed. So the fact that his DNA was there places him at the scene of a crime that he had no business being. And opposing counsel has mentioned the fact that there was no murder weapon. However, the evidence showed the victim was shot with a .22 caliber weapon, and in fact, police found missing weapons during their investigation, which was .22 caliber weapons.
They found missing weapons.
Sorry, Your Honor.
You might be right about that, because they found a picture of the guns, but they didn't find the guns. They found a case.
Correct.
They didn't find the guns.
Correct. So there's no evidence that Mr. Adams no longer had access to his guns. So the fact that there wasn't a murder weapon found is not completely significant. Mr. Opposing counsel also points the court to the fact that there was other men that the victim may have been associated with or known. However, the DNA lab evaluated and excluded 17 men from being contributors of DNA in this case, yet the DNA of Mr. Adams was found.
But the DNA lab evidence was a mess, to put it mildly. I mean, there's testimony about contamination. There's testimony about possible sample contamination because you have the sexual assault case going on contemporaneous with this capital case. And I mean, you had people testifying, well, yeah, they could have been mixed or whatever. I know you had somebody else come in and reevaluate the DNA evidence, but that's quite a muddle to go on to convict a person.
Your Honor, I would disagree that the DNA lab was a mess. In this case, there was no evidence of contamination. In fact, although the evidence from the sexual assault and the murder were evaluated on the same day, there's no evidence that they were evaluated at the same time. And the DNA analyst who evaluated both pieces of evidence testified that 100% of the time, she follows the lab policy of only opening one piece of evidence at a time, sealing it afterwards, bleaching her counter station, changing her gloves, and the butcher paper.
But what about the samples that were destroyed?
Your Honor, there were samples destroyed. However, contamination was readily apparent. It was easily known in that instance. Here, there's no reason to believe that the DNA from the sexual assault and murder case were contaminated. And opposing counsel also mentioned transference. However, Mr. Adams and the victim had not lived together in over 6 months. So the jury heard that information, and given their verdict, it's clear that they did not give substantial weight to Mr. Adams.
They lived together in that house 6 months before.
I'm sorry?
They lived together in that house 6 months
before. No, Your Honor. Not in that house.
This house was in Melissa, right?
This house was in Melissa, Texas, and in fact, the victim lived in at least two prior locations before moving to Melissa, Texas. So this was a completely different location before she moved.
Where did they live together?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have that.
They live together, but you're saying not in this house?
Not in Melissa, Texas. In fact, the house wasn't even in the victim's name, but Mr. Adams used his position working for a vehicle repossession company to track the victim over a matter of months, including 8 days before the crime, where his work computer showed he looked up the coordinates to her neighborhood, and 3 days before the crime, he looked up the coordinates to her actual address.
He was living in Frisco at the time?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And how far apart are Frisco and Melissa?
Your Honor, the Trial testimony revealed it was around 20 to 30 minutes, so it wasn't a long distance. And, Your Honor, the victim's son in this case testified that only a couple of weeks prior to her death, a blue tarp and handcuffs similar to that used in a sexual assault was dropped on her front porch. So his planning was evidence of his conduct in his case, in addition to the fact that the .22 caliber weapons that he owned were missing at the time of the crime.
Your Honor, what happened with the sexual assault? That was in 2013.
That was in March 2013, Your Honor. Where?
What happened in the system after that?
Your Honor, Mr. Adams was arrested, but he posted bond, I believe, within 2 days, and he wasn't indicted for that sexual assault until after the victim died.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. Opposing counsel also mentioned the cell phone records. However, the record shows Adams stopped using his phone 2 days before the crime, such that police believe that he had a second cell phone, and there was testimony that there were several numbers in connection with his name, Your Honor.
Well, but those cell phones, none of that exists as far as the record goes, right?
The other phones?
Yeah.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, the officers just are speculating. I mean, and you have the cell phone history that shows that he often went dark or didn't call before 11 o'clock in the morning or went several days without making a call. So none of this was necessarily remarkable.
Well, Your Honor, in light of the fact that he was repeatedly threatening to kill her and he was tracking her address despite a protective order against him and...
Yeah, but none of that has to do with his cell phone usage. And I'm just saying that his record of usage over time would be right akin to what happened during those couple of days leading up to the event.
Well, Your Honor, when you look at the entirety of the record, I would disagree with it and say that those records were significant. And this court has stated that to be sufficient to sustain a conviction, the evidence doesn't need to exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence or be completely inconsistent with every conclusion except guilt. Mr. Adams' arguments amounts to a challenge to the jury's credibility determinations, their weighing of the evidence, and the way that they resolved the evidence in this case. But the Supreme Court has recognized that Jackson leaves juries broad discretion in deciding what inferences to draw from the evidence presented at trial. Your Honors, Mr. Adams is a stalker, a rapist, and a murderer. He had everything to lose with his ex-fiancée alive and everything to gain with her dead. The jury in this case heard a substantial amount of evidence relating to the sexual assault, items from the sexual assault being dropped at her porch in Melissa, Texas, the way he tracked her just days before the murder, the fact that his colleague 3 days before the murder looked over his shoulder and saw him looking at a picture of the victim on his phone. And on one occasion, he was even reprimanded by his boss because he kept using their database to look up the victim's data. The victim's father testified in this case that she was scared to death. And less than a month before she died, she visited him and told him about all of the instances Mr. Adams repeatedly threatened to kill her and even bragged about working with the police and that they wouldn't be able to do anything to help. Her son testified in the end she stopped following her normal safety precautions, and he stated it was almost as if she gave up. After just 2 hours and 32 minutes, including lunch, the jury found Mr. Adams guilty as charged of capital murder. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Anything else? No, thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Yudish, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Alden, just real quick, just at the risk of belaboring this point, my co-counsel pulled up Jackson versus Virginia, and the Supreme Court says the question in this case is what standard is to be applied in a federal habeas corpus proceeding when the claim is made that a person has been convicted in a state court for an insufficient evidence.
Hunt, I'm so glad you brought back to it because I want to make sure, I still worry that we're not on the same page. The year of the decision you have in front of you is 1979, yes or no?
Yes.
17 years before AEDPA. So my question, this is why I wanted to, your answer to Judge Wilson earlier was, no. The question is not whether any reasonable jurist would have found the standard satisfied. And you keep citing a case from 1979. And the question I asked you at the very beginning is, do you have, and the word, by the way, because I have it in front of me too, I did a control F to make sure that the word deference appears nowhere in the opinion, which obviously it doesn't because it's in 17 years before we have the regime. So my question remains, do you have a case applying the AEDPA deferential standards of 2254D to a Jackson claim?
Yes.
And it is?
Well, there's several cases cited in our brief from other circuits. And there's also, I found last night, two cases out of this circuit that I'm sorry we didn't find in the brief, but Perez versus Kane, 529 Fed 3rd, 588, and Donahue versus Kane, 231 Fed 3rd, 1000, both out of the Fifth Circuit. And the first one's a 2008 case, second one's 2000 case. Those are both EPA cases.
Granting relief under Jackson.
Yes. And
it's troubling because obviously you didn't cite them, so I haven't had a chance to read them.
Well, that's our fault, and I apologize for that.
What we're talking about is Jackson plus EPA, right? That's what we're talking about.
Well, I still think you have to apply the Jackson standard first because there's no way to tell whether the Court of Appeals decision was reasonable. And let me just, I guess, quickly before I run out of time, because on the DNA evidence, I assume no court's really articulated this, but I assume that when judges are looking at this, they say you can draw some kind of inference from the DNA that Mike Adams was in the house, when all the experts say you can't draw that inference. And so I would say if Adams and Ledger had never known each other, had never lived together, never dated, never had any contact with each other, and you find his DNA in the house, then that might be a reasonable, rational inference to draw.
But do you agree with Ms. Reeves that he never lived with her in that house and Melissa?
I do agree with that. There's testimony in the record. He delivered a letter to a handwritten letter to that house after she moved into it. He, according to the testimony, delivered a tarp and handcuffs. So things were coming to that house that could have his DNA on it.
Delivered is quite a word, but how would his DNA get onto the condom in her master bedroom bath? I'm sorry, master bathroom, excuse me.
Yeah, so two possible ways. One, contamination in the lab. Despite what the state is arguing, the lab work, I think you can tell from the testimony, was not 100% accurate all the time because there were samples taken from the house that the lab, through negligence, lost. And so they weren't able to be analyzed. And so for the analyst to come and say, oh, I never make a mistake 100% of the time, this is what I do, is a little hard to believe. And the same analyst was analyzing the sexual assault DNA evidence at the same time she was analyzing the murder evidence. So that's one possibility. The other, all the experts testify, DNA can transfer from when they live together to the house. Could be on a towel, a sheet, I mean, anything.
May I ask you, I know we're running out of time, but that's okay. You're likely not the trial attorney for Mr. Adams, but what is your appreciation? What was the primary defense that was argued to the jury by Mr. Adams' counsel?
So essentially what I'm arguing, that he was not the person that did it.
Was there an attempt to shift blame to someone else or no?
Well, there was some of that. I mean, because there were samples from a number of unknown men found in this house. Mm-hmm. And in moist condoms, clearly people were in the house within a short period of time before this happened.
I mean, thinking about Greer.
They tried to put a lot of emphasis on Greer. Greer's a good example, if I may, of looking at what the Court of Appeals said and talking about the evidence. In the Court of Appeals opinion, they refer to Greer's timesheet as evidence that he was at work, so he couldn't have done it.
Oh, yes, I read that in your reply.
Well, and if you look at the timesheet, which is in evidence, it's clear that it's a pre-signed timesheet. It's dated and signed before a lot of the dates on the timesheet where it claims that he's working.
Yeah, but I understand that. But my question, I understand, I don't want to argue about the evidence. I'm just interested in was this argued to the jury?
Yeah, the defense did try to shift blame to other people, also to the lab. They called a DNA expert to say just the same thing that the state's expert said, this could transfer. So it was kind of a multi-pronged defense. But it kind of boiled down to the same thing that I'm arguing. There is no reasonable inference from that DNA that he was there.
Okay. Any other questions? No. Thank you, counsel.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for a well-argued case. We'll take the matter under submission. That ends our argued cases for the day, and we'll be back tomorrow. Thank you.